In 1987, I was a 13-year-old kid who loved to read. And then I saw this commercial.
How would you explain it? A woman in Wisconsin is doing the dishes when suddenly she's possessed by a terrifying feeling. She's positive that her young daughter has just been in an accident. She quickly makes a desperate phone call, only to learn that her feeling was true. How would you explain this? A dozen people around the world who never met each other describe an encounter with a being from space, and their descriptions of the creature match almost exactly. And how do you explain this? A man's heart stops beating in a hospital, and he sees a blinding light that doesn't frighten him, but fills him with an indescribable feeling of peace. And how can you explain the growing number of people who feel that they've had a brush with something beyond our everyday understanding? Maybe no one can fully explain these things, but they can no longer be ignored. That's why Time Life takes a serious look into this world with a remarkable new series, Mysteries of the Unknown, to provide an objective and comprehensive look at what may lie beyond our ordinary reality. How can you explain this? Four men are drawn to an ancient Anglo-Saxon fort, site of a fierce battle. They enter the shadows of a ring of trees, and without warning, one of them is grabbed by an unseen force, lifted 5 feet in the air, and suspended for 30 full seconds. There are so many hints of a world more remarkable than we ever imagined, and of abilities that we barely suspect.
Mommy, all I could think of was you.
I know.
Send for your first volume on a free trial basis and see if you can explain these things away.
To order your first book, Mystic Places, call 1-800-548-4600. Examine it for 10 days. Keep it and pay just $12.99 plus shipping and handling. Other books will follow, one about every other month. Keep only the ones you want. Cancel any time. Call 1-800-548-4600.
I mean, am I right? How many of my Gen X brothers and sisters out there remember Mysteries of the Unknown? I asked my mom, I begged my mom, please order me that first book. It was free for 10 days. I'd read it and we could send it back. No worries. But man, I was hooked. That first edition really lit me up. And as you might have guessed, we never sent the book back, and I looked forward to every new volume like it was Christmas. We canceled the subscription a few years later, my senior year in high school, I think, and I had 10 or 11 volumes by then. I moved out when high school was done, didn't take the books with me, and over the years, they were either lost or donated to the local library where I grew up. I didn't realize until recently that the series went on to produce over 30 volumes, but those first 10, man, the stories, the writing, the blatant conjecture and suppositions, that's right up my alley. And so here we are, what, more than 35 years later? And so many topics explored in those books are still making news today. Paranormal stuff, unexplained phenomenon, mythical creatures, topics we cover on The Devil Within every week. So what I'd like to do, considering there exists in this book series such a comprehensive library that dives into hundreds of interesting, amazing, and terrifying stories. I mean, it's basically a time capsule. These books represent the scientific understanding of a world before the internet, of a world before massive leaps forward in investigative technologies, before advancements in geology and chemistry, before a more intimate knowledge of the human brain, before the human genome was mapped, or the Higgs boson was discovered, before the Hubble telescope. There have been monumental advancements in virtually every scientific field in the years since these books were published, and I'm interested in finding out where our current understanding of these ideas clash with the best understanding of 35 years ago. The first, I guess we call it investigation, in the first volume of Mysteries of the Unknown deals with the fabled lost city of Atlantis. In recent years, the Aquaman movies starring Jason Momoa have depicted a version of Atlantis that still exists as an underwater kingdom, full of human-looking beings that can breathe underwater and swim super fast. They have all this cool technology and weapons, and they live in a sort of limbo with the humans of dry land because we, you know, we've treated the ocean as our own giant trash can for thousands of years, so who can blame them? But the real Atlantis, as real as a fabled city can be, was first written about by Plato. Yeah, that Plato, the ancient Greek philosopher who founded the Academy in Athens, the student of Socrates and teacher of Aristotle. A major influence, if not the major influence, in all of modern philosophy, Plato gave us his theory of forms, his theory of the soul, the Platonic solids, as well as his dialogues on ethics, politics, epistemology, and of course, the Republic, the allegory of the cave. Also included in his so-called Socratic dialogues is a piece where he presents Socrates, his teacher, speaking with a man named Critias. Plato wrote primarily from perspectives other than his own in what he called dialogues. He would have two characters, Socrates always being one of them, discussing a topic in the form of a conversation. And in that conversation, he would lay out his philosophy, complete with arguments, points and counterpoints, all in an effort to clearly express his views. In this particular dialogue, Socrates asks Critias about ancient Athens and how that powerful city-state interacted with other cultures. And boy, did Critias have a story to tell. It seems the grandfather of Critias had occasion to meet an Athenian poet named Solon, who had actually traveled to Egypt and sat with priests and compared Athens with Egypt, including their gods, their customs, their respective ambitions as separate cultures. And one story sung by these Egyptian priests concerned Atlantis. Here's what those Egyptian priests told Solon, who told Critias' grandfather, who told Critias, who told Socrates, in a fake dialogue written by Plato. All right, you got all that? Okay. It was roughly 9,000 years before Plato's time that a powerful island empire existed in the Atlantic Ocean, west of the Pillars of Hercules, what we know today as the Strait of Gibraltar, a narrow, 8-mile-wide stretch of water that connects the Mediterranean Sea with the Atlantic Ocean and separates Europe to the north from the African continent to the south. Atlantis was reportedly a tremendously powerful and influential maritime civilization, ruling several other islands in the extended area and even parts of Europe and North Africa. The description of Atlantis was awe-inspiring. Generations of wise and humble kings had created a land of unsurpassed beauty and technology, with fields of rich soil extending from the mountains to the sea, a system of aqueducts that provided water in abundance for irrigation, plumbing, baths, and even great fountains in the city centers. The capital city, also called Atlantis, was laid out in concentric circles of land separated by great canals. And in the center of the royal complex stood the Temple of Poseidon, a wing of the royal residence, and it was the grandest of all buildings to ever exist, apparently, surpassing even the pyramids of Giza several millennia later. The larger palace compound contained the houses of the Atlantean aristocracy, stunning mansions of stone built by master craftsmen out of native rock, which was of a quality not found anywhere else. You get what they're talking about here. The place was incredible. And further, the natural resources of the island, combined with the trading expertise of the merchant class of Atlantis, provided what Plato described as, quote, a wealth so immense that the like had never been seen before in any royal house, nor will ever easily be seen again. So what happened? According to Critias, Atlantis got a little too big for her britches. An unprovoked imperialistic war was waged against who the Atlanteans perceived to be their biggest threat to total dominance of the area: Athens. But remember, this isn't the Athens of the Peloponnesian War. This is 9,000 years before that. They weren't yet the naval superpower they would become, with nowhere near the military capabilities in either weapons or manpower that Atlantis commanded. But they had one thing the other guys didn't: the righteousness that comes with fighting for your own freedom. Athens showed the leadership that one day all of Greece would recognize as they defeated the invading forces and secured their own freedom and that of those previously enslaved by the suddenly corrupt former utopia. In the days that followed the stunning defeat of Atlantis, there were allegedly a series of cataclysmic events, primarily a massive earthquake followed by devastating floods that caused the entire continent of Atlantis to sink into the ocean. In Mysteries of the Unknown, it's revealed that Plato's most famous student, Aristotle, disagreed with his teacher's account of the lost continent and insisted that it was merely a parable to warn against the hubris that wealth and power so often bring, and that the tale also clearly posits a cultural war between the modesty of Athens and the wealth of Atlantis, as well as military engineering versus spiritual righteousness. And with that, the matter seemed to have been settled for the next couple thousand years, until 1882, when a man named Ignatius Donnelly wrote a book called Atlantis, the Antediluvian World. It was a massive success that reignited the world's interest in the possibility that thousands of years before even the Egyptians, there existed an entire continent with a highly advanced civilization, arguably the father of all future civilizations, that was lost forever in a major naturally occurring catastrophic event. This book even found its way into the halls of high academia, with the likes of Charles Darwin and other luminaries of the day chiming in. The word antediluvian in the title was of tremendous interest because it directly referenced the biblical flood that so many believers point to as God's wrath for the very things that Atlantis and her denizens were guilty of. Plus, the text was chock full of supposed facts that Donnelly spent years researching. He even had a list of possible locations, one of which would explode into the zeitgeist years later and offer a clear glimpse into American culture in the late 1800s, and the rise of the spiritualists. Okay, you've all heard me talk about Factor before. Factor is a company that delivers meals ready to heat and eat that are obviously delicious, nutritious, and easy. But here's how Factor has seriously made my life better. So, we all have certain days of the week that always seem to just get away from us, right? For me, it's Tuesdays and Thursdays. I go from the studio to picking up the kids right into driving them to their separate athletic events. By the end of the day, I was always irritable because I didn't have time to eat. When I started ordering meals from Factor, all that changed. Just those 2 days being more manageable made a huge difference in my life. Because they're 2-minute meals. No shopping, no prep time, no cleanup. They have breakfast, lunch, dinner, and snack options. Keto, calorie conscious, protein heavy, smoothies, you name it, they have it. Factor heat and eat meals are the perfect option if you need fast, premium meals that are less expensive than takeout. Seriously, they did the math. It's less expensive. So sign up and save. Head to factormeals.com/devilwithin50 and use code DEVILWITHIN50 to get 50% off. That's code DEVILWITHIN50 at factormeals.com/devilwithin50 to get 50% off. As mentioned in a recent episode, a spiritualist is a person who believes that dead people exist in a plane that is tantalizingly close to ours, and that certain humans with the gift are able to actually speak with them. One of the most popular of these spiritualists was a man named Edgar Cayce, also known as the Sleeping Prophet, as all of his readings were delivered from a deep, trance-like state. Edgar Cayce, he picked up on the Atlantis interest sweeping the nation and began to communicate with former residents of that once great civilization. His popularity skyrocketed, and he was soon commanding audiences in the thousands, and his tales of Atlantis were taken as fact. At one particular reading in 1938, Casey claimed that the Atlantic island nation of the Bahamas would provide clear evidence that Atlantis had existed near the small island of Bimini, not far off the coast of southern Florida. Miraculously, 30 years later, a rock formation that experts believed to be man-made was found just off the coast of Bimini. The rock formation consists of massive limestone rectangular blocks that appear to form a segment of a large road or a wall. This discovery was widely regarded to have proven Casey correct. Casey also mentioned several times the rough date of 12,000 years ago, which would correspond perfectly with the dates Plato wrote about in his dialogues. The same year Edgar Casey was born, 1877, the discovery of the earliest known civilization in Europe was made on the island of Crete, the largest island in Greece. Dating to 7,000 BC, Knossos was a major site of the Minoan civilization. It's spelled K-N-O-S-S-O-S, and I'm assuming the K is silent, but I'd be embarrassed if I'm wrong about that. If I am, I apologize. And the great palace of Minos dominated the city center. When the site was further excavated in 1900, it became a global news story, and shortly after, an anonymous article was written that suggested that Knossos was actually the lost city of Atlantis. The author provided an extraordinary set of reasons for the claim. The primary thesis of the piece was that if you looked at the history of the island of Crete from the perspective of the Egyptians, it all falls into place. Remember, the Egyptian priests were the genesis of the Atlantis that Plato wrote about, a powerful, cultured island nation with a great army and massive wealth. Although Crete, obviously, is clearly a Mediterranean island and not in the Atlantic, it's often misunderstood, by myself included, that the name Atlantis refers to a geographical location, when in fact, it has to do with the first king of Atlantis, a young man named Atlas, son of Poseidon. So, this theory was worth investigating, but due to the anonymity of the author, among other things, it was largely ignored. Until, that is, a young Greek archaeologist named Spyridon Marinatos decided to make a career out of it. In 1938, Marinatos made a discovery of his own: Minoan buildings on the island of Thera. Thera lies just under 90 miles due north of Crete, and here's the important part. What remains of Thera is basically half of an exploded volcano. Marinatos basically argued that an eruption of the size that could decimate an island as large as Thera, which obviously happened, could undoubtedly also have been responsible for the destruction of Crete and everyone on it. The only problem was that the dates didn't jive with Plato's account of Atlantis. The eruption that wiped out Thera and possibly Crete occurred around 1500 BC, only a little more than 1,000 years before Plato. That date fits within the time frame where the ancient Egyptians would have knowledge of it and could have passed that along the chain that eventually would reach Plato. But why would Plato give the date of 9,000 years ago? This disparity was reconciled with the application of Occam's razor. 14th century British philosopher William of Occam proposed that when faced with a dilemma, the simplest explanation that fits all the facts is most likely the correct one. So how does that apply here? Well, both the Egyptians and the Greeks used 10-based number schemes that predated but would eventually lead to our modern decimal system. It was reasoned that somewhere along the line in the translation from Egyptian to Greek, whatever the symbol was for every number greater than 100 was erroneously granted an additional zero. If that in fact happened to be the case, all of Plato's estimations would be correct. If when he wrote 9,000 years, it should actually have been 900 years, then we're right in the ballpark. Plato also wrote that the great capital city of Atlantis measured 300 miles across. But if it were really 30 miles, that would comport nicely with what was discovered on Crete. This discrepancy could also account for the presumed location Plato imagined for the lost continent. Something as big as Plato wrote about would have to have existed beyond the Pillars of Hercules, and not in the considerably smaller Mediterranean Sea. But a continent one-tenth the size? Of course it could. Is it possible that these numbers could have been mixed up? Obviously, yes. Plato was no doubt completely enthralled with the extraordinary tale of an entire continent being wiped out in the blink of an eye, and I doubt his Egyptian was such that translation would have been super easy for him. But was it all just a parable to Plato, a useful tool to get a point across about hubris and arrogance and the wrath of vengeful gods? There are many who feel satisfied with this version of events and consider the matter settled. But they all miss one glaring problem. Crete isn't underwater. So what gives? Where does all this leave us? We have an ancient account of an entire continent that was completely destroyed in less than 2 days and was completely swallowed by the ocean. Massive earthquakes and floods that some believed was the work of angry gods, for the people of Atlantis had grown too arrogant and lost all traces of humility, even in the face of their gods. To prove that they could go their own way, they waged an unjust war against a perceived weaker foe in Athens, but were roundly defeated. Then, as the final punishment, the cataclysm arrived, the dreadful day of reckoning, as Mysteries of the Unknown so eloquently put it, which sealed their fate forever. In Plato's dialogue, it occurred 9,000 years before his time. The researcher and writer, Ignatius Donnelly, put the date at 12,000 years from his time, which is consistent with Plato's version. Edgar Cayce and other spiritualists no doubt exploited the Atlantis craze that dominated the early to mid-1900s, so we can't really put much stake in his sleeping readings. But he also subscribed to the 12,000 years ago timeframe, plus he got a major hit with the Bimini thing. Even though he never got to bask in that glory, having died in 1945, 23 years before the discovery of the Bimini Road. Mysteries of the Unknown also lists over a dozen sites for Atlantis, but fails to make any definitive conclusions. About the only thing they all agree on is that something terrible happened about 12,000 years ago. And maybe, because of that cataclysmic event, an entire continent that contained an advanced civilization was completely swallowed by the sea. On the next episode, we'll take a look at our modern understanding of Atlantis, how the theories have changed and evolved, and if we're any closer to getting the answers that have been sought for thousands of years. That's next time on The Devil Within. The Devil Within is a Cloud 10 Media production, recorded live at Bel Air Studios in Los Angeles, California. Written and produced by Brandon Morgan. Executive produced by Sim Sarna. Our post-production supervisor is Bruce Witkin, who also provided original music for this episode. For The Devil Within, I'm your host, Brandon Morgan.
Hey there, I'm Amara Kofer, and I'm the host of the show Black Girl Gone. In this podcast, I tell the stories of missing and murdered Black women and women of color in America. I want to bring light and awareness to all of these powerful stories. I focus on a neglected demographic and missing and murdered cases and send my love and respect to the victims. I recommend listening to Black Girl Gone on the iHeart app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.